Welcome to the Welly Sport Podcast, where our aim is to provide interesting sports-related conversations with anyone from the world of sport, including old Wellingtonians now involved in sport or other individuals who now work within the world of sport. For this episode, I, Mr. McDonald, am joined by Hector Elrington, who captained the seven this year and was a consistent member of the 15 for this 2 years in sixth form. We're also joined by World Cup winner, 2003 England player, Will Greenwood. And we're going to get stuck into his experiences around elite sport as a player, as a pundit, and now more recently what he's been doing in school sport as a parent and as a teacher and coach at the school level. We're interested in what his experiences around elite sport and that, and how he uses that knowledge to help others in many different environments and spaces on the sports field, in the business environment, and in and around interactions with parents. So firstly, Hector, how are you? I hope lockdown's treating you well. What are you doing with yourself at the moment?
I'm good, thank you, sir. Doing a lot to keep myself busy, which is good, keeping me happy. Giving a few family trims, for the fresh trims, which is good. And then a bit of fitness here and there, just keeping up to date, just keeping ticking so that all school's fine.
That's more fitness than you do when you're at school.
Yeah, exactly. School's all right. Lessons are good. I mean, it's all just sort of uncertainty around uni and gap year at the moment, which has been a little bit stressful. Really finding the extension courses in my lessons really helpful and interesting. So it's all good.
Oh, that's cool. So let's, for people that maybe don't know who you are, Hector, and people listening to this, what's your Wellington story? Like, why did you come here? Where were you before? What have you done?
So I was at Molesford, a prep school in Oxfordshire. Absolutely loved it there. Played a lot of rugby. We had these Ollie Barkley courses, actually. And I remember quite a few Wellington people would actually come out and help in some courses. And I remember talking to them about it, finding out loads more. Wellington's a big name for rugby as well. So a really good place to sort of further my rugby. Really liked the sound of Wellington. Then Wellington tournament was also a big thing. So we would go there, play in the competition. Loved Big Side One. Loved the sort of atmosphere and the stuff around Wellington, which was great, really liked the idea. So yeah, joined Wellington 2015, loved it ever since. Very happy to have joined. Loved the rugby. Good years in third form, fourth form, and fifth form, actually. Had a pretty good side over the last 3 years, and then lower sixth, found myself trickle between sort of first and seconds in a few matches. But managed to stick at it, and then in my final year at Wellington, really happy with how it all went, playing for the first team, so yeah, all very good.
And were you involved in any other sports in the sort of younger years, or you mainly focused on rugby towards the end?
I played a decent amount of cricket, really enjoyed that actually. I used to play some Berkshire cricket for Wellington, so yeah, really enjoyed playing sort of B team, A team cricket for the first few years. Which was really enjoyable. Then in sixth form, ventured off to golf.
nice.
Which I claimed I was amazing at, but could not play golf for my life. It's a hard game, actually. It's all been good. Enjoyed all the aspects of sport here at Wellington.
And Greens, welcome the other side of a podcast for you today. Thanks for coming on and giving us your time. How are you? Can you give us a brief story around your sort of school sports to start with?
My school sports should have finished in 1983. I won the Molesis under 11 sevens. Molesis would be like a northern Molesford. And, I went there with St Mary's Hall as a nine-year-old, scored a hat-trick in the final, and my mum said, should have walked away. I remember Robert Robson, Dominic Bentham, all your mates from school had a wonderful time. We were Green and White Hoops, SMH, the junior school to Stonyhurst. My mum was a maths teacher there. My dad taught geography. And I played a lot of cricket, a lot of triple jump, entered every competition, nationals, whatever it was. Happy to come fifth, just loved competing at all. Got taught table tennis by Desmond Douglas, who was one of the great table tennis players of the 1980s. Moved on to Sedba when I was 12. So what sent up to boarding school, was about an hour and a half away from home. didn't go to the senior school at Stonyhurst. My dad, it was sort of the comedy value of my dad sending me to Sedba because Stonyhurst weren't quite as good as rugby. And I then perfectly timed the worst 5 years of Sedba rugby ever. By the same time, Stonyhurst had Kieran Bracken, Paul Flood, Jonty Warnicken, Vince Gradias, and had the greatest Stonyhurst team of all time, which was 643 yards from my front door. So I learned to scrap it out, dog it out, do 11-mile runs. I know at Wellington they talk about the Kingsleys, which is like 5K or something, and it gets cancelled if there's a little bit of snow on the ground. We go waist-deep in snow. And we top it out, and that's maybe why the Browns have the mocker on Wellington at rugby at the moment, because they're just slightly mentally tougher.
Yeah.
I know Molesford really well, where Hector was. My eldest used to go to Caldicot, so we came across there, and a great friend of mine from Durham University now runs a lot of the sport there, so knew the quality of the sport there. Then first came across Hector when I remember him, things you hear in Waitrose. And Hector knows exactly what I'm going to say now. I joined, I think it's on the, is it on the Derby pitches, the other side of the railway lines?
Yeah.
And it was under 15s training. And it was Mr. Barrett and Mr. McDonald, yourself. I came across and I got involved in the warm up. And it must have been the start of the Easter term, because Hector was moaning about his hamstrings. And what's the matter? I said, oh, just too much skiing. My hamstrings are so tight. And I thought, things you hear in Waitrose every day. So I came across him there, and I remember seeing some outstanding talent, great footwork. Unfortunately, I think picked up concussion, which meant he couldn't play in the final at Twickenham, but was chief water boy, chief assistant, there all training, everything you'd want from a club man. I mean, people talk about great Lions. Jason Leonard went to 1997 Lions Tour, was expected to start the Test Series, didn't, got displaced by Paul Wallace. And he could have gone off in a huff and thought, I'm not playing anymore. I'm 100 caps for England, I should be playing. And became the great team man. And it's that sort of selfless attitude. And then tracked Hector, still a lot of respect for what he's done, because I see his physique, my physique, skinny fellas, bit of footwork, not built to play rugby, but learned to survive on their wits. And one of the phrases I always stuck to was the strong take from the weak, but the smart take from the strong. And as he's slowly filled out, the game's come back to him. And in his final year, I thought Hector absolutely smashed it out on the park. Keen to learn, daft neck chain, dodgy Barnett, dyes his hair. Who would ever dye their hair? I don't know. And a lot of fun. So then the other part of the question is, where did I meet Robin Dyer? I knew Robin Dyer for years. And my lifestyle is a lot of working at weekends, international test matches, commentary, journalism, and I did a couple of other things. So occasionally I had a couple of days off during the week, and I'm not the sort of guy who wants to sit around and go play golf. So I just literally mentioned it to Robin that I was thinking of a couple of ideas that I might want to do. And Robin said, well, why don't you start in September? I said, start what in September? He said, come and teach. So I started in economics and realized the sixth form economics students were far more intelligent than I could ever hope to be, even though I did economics at Durham University for 3 years, and switched into maths in lower school level up to GCSE. And since then I've crossed paths with some outstanding students, had some fun, and I'm sort of, they still keep inviting me back.
What did you do after school, Greg? You didn't go straight into professional rugby, did you? What was your journey out of school for the sort of sixth formers that are in that space at the moment? We've talked to Finn. Finn, a couple of weeks ago, who's going into Queen's Academy. I've talked to James, who left and played in New Zealand. Sam obviously went to professional. What was your route into after school?
So rugby wasn't professional. It was an amateur sport. I played at a team called Preston Grasshoppers and then Waterloo throughout my Durham University career. So I played Saturdays for my club, and Wednesdays I played university rugby. In the old days, there was no player welfare. Just got on with two games. You didn't tell anyone you had concussion because you missed 3 weeks, and you just find yourself back out on the pitch. I finished my degree, applied for a job in the city. I used to work for HSBC. I was a foreign exchange trader. and a futures trader for 3 years, and then rugby turned professional overnight, really on the back of what Lomu did at the World Cup in 1995. And I was going to move from Quinns, where I was playing as an amateur, Harlequins, and going to move and play with my mates down at Roslyn Park and sack off professional rugby. I was doing all right in the city. I was offered a derogatory contract by Harlequins on a take-it-or-leave-it three-year basis, and I thought, well, that's just ridiculous. I'll just go and have some fun with my pals. And then my dad had a conversation with me and said, don't be the bloke at the end of the bar who says he could have done. And I said, what do you mean? He said, don't be bitter in 20 years. It's better to have tried and failed than not to have tried at all. So we had a sort of two-year bet. I spoke to the bank, HSBC, and said, can I go? And is there a job for me if it doesn't work out? And they said, sure, no problem. And I went to Leicester, played up at Leicester, played behind a pack that had, you know, Martin Johnson, Neil Back, Graham Rowntree, Dean Richards, backline. Me and Austin Healy joined at the same time, and was fortunate. We made a European Cup final year one. We won the league. We won the Tetley Bitter Cup, and I got picked to go on a Lions tour before I played for England. So my rugby career sort of took off, and I never really went back to the city. When I finished playing in 06, the city was a very different place to what it was when I was first working in it 15 years ago. So I became a commentator, pundit, and a businessman running some organisations outside on a sort of part-time consultancy base.
Where would Durham University sit in your sort of memories of everything you've just talked about there, in terms of how you got there, been on a Lions tour before you played for England? Obviously, you've won World Cup, which some of us still hoping to do. Some of us haven't ruled it out yet. But where would the Durham University days sit on that in your sort of memories?
It's such a good question. I mean, I think everyone assumes, you know, tell me your favourite moment. Was it Sydney? Was it beating the All Blacks in New Zealand? I go, no, it was away from home. We beat Cardiff University away in the quarterfinal of the UAU. And we had an 8-hour bus trip back. My friends, I've got a great deal of respect. I've got a lot of colleagues from my professional rugby days. Got a lot of, you know, I have got good friends, but my best mates, boys and girls, are my university pals. I often joke, you can take the medal, don't take away my 3 years at Durham. Mm-hmm. You know, don't deny me those memories. And yeah, I laugh about it. The WhatsApp groups I still have are on with my Durham mates in this lockdown period. We catch up once, maybe twice a week. I'm writing a book with an old Durham lad. My housemate Mazza Susie make sure the people who lived in 31 Sutton Street get on the Zoom call once a week, and they're the memories I treasure. The pot noodles, the dodgy nightclubs, the training in front of sort of cars with headlights on in order to create some sort of light, because no one had put a quid in the electricity meter down at Maiden Castle in Durham, and we didn't have any light. And just discovering myself, really, because I know that sounds like a bit zen, but I've been to an all-boys school and I lived in a tiny little village in Blackburn where all my mates, so I only knew lads and I only knew blokes and I only knew sport. I didn't know how to cook. I had no idea about washing. I'd have a very, you know, we weren't wealthy in any way, shape or form, but I'd been really well looked after in my little village and I knew my little bubble. And it was just this three-year journey of discovery. And on a rugby pitch, it was perfect for me and my physique, who would have been chewed up and spat out as an 18-year-old if I'd been in an academy. Just there's different ways to approach rugby. And I just kept turning up, having a lot of fun. And eventually my physique filled out and caught up, and the bits that I'd picked up with my wit and cunning then came back into play. But if I was born now, then it would have been really off-putting. And actually those that feel, oh, I'm not in an academy now, I say, don't worry about it. You'll find your level. Just keep turning up, keep playing, keep enjoying, hang out with your mates. And, you know, if your level is level four, if your level is Roslyn Park or Barnes, it's still brilliant. And I would still have played rugby.
So I kind of just wanted some advice for people sort of my age and sort of moving from school to uni, that sort of transition, and just the importance, like what is the importance of keeping your rugby going through that transition? And like, as you said, you made great friendships through Durham, and especially would have been in your rugby team as well, and just making sure you, because I've heard loads of people who have sort of dropped out of rugby teams as soon as they start in uni, and I just want to know the importance of like that, making sure that transition is successful from school to uni.
Yeah, really important. I mean, I think the key is it transitions here from whether or not you're leaving Wellington as a rugby player, or you're leaving Wellington as a dancer or a debater. My whole point is, when you go to university, go and find your kin. Go and find, it's not just about hanging around with people that look like you and feel like you and do the same things that you, but when you go to these new places, having a foothold in a collective that allows you then to branch out, because they'll know three different people each and you'll know three different people each, and suddenly this bubble grows, and then over time you'll work out who you want to hang out with. But not only are you growing your social circle in a much broader aspect and capacity, but you're also doing something that you love that can be a release from the hard work that uni is. You know, my dad always laughed, and he jokes about it. He goes, "Will, you read rugby and you played economics." And it's exactly what I did. And that ability, I think, to have a circle that is your work circle and your downtime circle is critical to a happy time, to having activities going on and not just going home from a rubbish day of lectures and going, "Oh my God, I've got an essay to do. Go switch the brain off, go run around, go have a game of touch." That's my point. And I think I was lucky. I got invited on a Durham University tour before I arrived, actually, because they picked four or five people who were okay to go with them. I think people like Jack Reed and Fitz Hardy may have done that recently in different places, and jumped at it. And it meant I had a load of mates in there, like in the second year. When I arrived, I was like, "This guru, like, who's this guy?" People in the second. If you've got rugby boots, rock up, man. You'll meet so many new people. And as you then leave uni, that transitions into going and joining your local club, because you'll meet people in the local village or town that can get you out of a hole when you need it.
As is the nature with the sort of players at schools like Wellington Grange, they might find that university might be the first time they're not in a first team. So it's like Hector's talked a lot there about his Wellington experience. He's only ever been in the first team. He played a little bit in the second team in his lower sixth year when I wasn't picking him, so we won't talk too much about that. But if Hector played a whole season without any first team rugby, let's say at university, that would be the first time that's happened since ever, I guess. Hector, is that right?
Yeah.
And how does that all fit in, Greens? Where do you see that experience?
So there's the assumption, right? He won a World Cup, he's first team uni, straight in. Nah, chance. I was a fly half, right? And the first team captain was called Nick Canning, and he was a fly half. The second team captain was, I can't remember his name, Hilden Bede, fly half. Third team captain, Jim Kennedy, fly half. I was in the fourth. I went straight in the fourth. I did a season in the fourth, half a season in the fourth, half a season in the third, and finally scraped into it. And I think it's this assumption that it's like telling you to relax, like telling an alcoholic not to drink. it doesn't really help. But my point would be, if you love it, right? It doesn't matter what team you're playing in. And people say, why are you coaching at Maidenhead in Division 74 South West East or whatever? And what you coach, you were at Welly, and sometimes you get sent down and you go with the Invincibles. What's Mr. Lindo's fifth team called? Not the Vulcans,
the Ultras.
Right? Best sessions ever. Or you hang out with the third, is it young Ed Morrison? People like that. And you see those guys, and it's like, you know what? It does. Just give me a bunch of people who want to be slightly better. So to answer your question, Kyle, it's unlikely. No one spends their entire life in the first team. Not even Martin Johnson. He was dropped by England. Yeah. It doesn't happen. And the reality is, actually learning how to fight for your place is fun.
We also got into there a little bit around the academy stuff, Green. So you've, again, you must have seen the full growth of that. Hector, were you in an academy as a youngster?
So starting off very early at Oxfordshire, which was like a partnership with Wasps, and I played there for a while, sort of moved into the Wasps DPP. And then coming to Wellington, we moved into London Irish, because they came and coached every sort of Monday or Tuesday. at during the week, so that was a lot easier. And then, yeah, went on for a bit with London Irish, and then things ended. But it was a good experience. Can't say I enjoyed much of the structure a lot of the time, and quite a lot, like sort of the pressure they put on you, in a way. It wasn't too bad.
And what was the reason that they said to you that when did London Irish part ways with you?
Beginning of lower sixth. It was a weird one actually. It did come to a lot of sizing, a lot of not being able to gym, like not gymming enough really. But then also sort of the factor that I didn't really invest enough sort of motivation into it, and I didn't really like fulfill what I should have done, especially like turning up to training and stuff like that, which I regret a lot now. I think the competition was high, and at times of my last, so my fifth form years, my confidence was not, as Green's touched on earlier, with the concussion in fourth form, and the NatWest final at Twickenham. I struggled a bit in fifth form, and that sort of put me back a bit, not my confidence, and sort of started that sort of those academy sort of matches and stuff. So that's what led to sort of being parting ways. Yeah, so I wanted to sort of ask about sort of the systems the RFU sort of have in place, mainly for school programs, but then also around academy programs and how it's all set up, and whether you think it's done in the right way, whether you think sort of the training is done to the right professionalism, and whether you'd be doing anything different if you were maybe head of one of these academies or school programs and stuff like that.
It's a fascinating question, that. And I don't jump from pillar to post. I try and be consistent in my thoughts. I've never been a massive fan of academies at the age of 13, 14, 15. I'm not a massive fan in specialisation. Now, I understand clubs, specifically football, want to get hold of the next Ronaldo whilst he's cheap and he's 13 years old and he can get in an academy, and you, as opposed to having to buy one at 21 for 200 million quid. And so I understand that search for that. I feel with academies, certainly that during the summer, if you play tennis and cricket, go play tennis and cricket. Don't go to a gym and just spend 3 months in a gym. So one of the things I have on that, but I can't completely shoot the system, because I understand that you want to increase your skill sets, and to have coaches come down and support you is an amazing thing to have as a 13, 14-year-old, to understand if you're hooker, the best things to use your core when you're throwing in, or you're drop punting, you've got a kicking coach come along. So it's, I think the key is to try and find that balance and allow kids to maintain the smile on their face. Allow kids sometimes to tap out and understand, like, he's not going to come on a Monday or a Wednesday. He's tired, he's got his maths homework, and it's tough, and his history, and he needs to get his sort out. I feel it tallies in with what you're saying a little bit. There's perhaps player burnout, and the quantity just loses people's imagination, sparkle, and why they actually took up the game. Now, it comes from a good place, and the last thing I want to do is have a pop at people at the RFU, because there are a lot of friends who work there, and they want people to develop, and they want people to be better people. I just think it's just taken a lot of time for a lot of this thing to find its own level in the race for professionalism and the race to copy sports that have been professional for a long time. And the one thing I would say, my strongest point of it all would be, just because you don't make an academy does not mean you're not a good rugby player. And I think there's too many kids who go, I got cut at 15, I might as well pack it in, there's no point. That for me is the greatest crime of academies, that we have a history and a litany of players that have given up the game or become disillusioned with the game because some mug has told them at 15 they weren't good enough. I left an England schools training camp in 1989 at Castlecroft, and I was told that rugby wasn't for me. And because I was spat out of rucks, because I was at 4 stone wet through, in modern terminology, that's 20 kilos, you know. So, but I just loved it. So, again, you know what? I'm just going to keep turning up anyway. But a lot of people react badly to that sort of feedback. So the idea of the academies, the skill acquisition, the mentoring with senior players who are pro, so much of it is great, as long as they have the player and his mental and physical well-being at the forefront of everything they're doing, as opposed to, we need a first team fly half within 3 years, he's a robot, we're turning him into one.
That segues quite nicely actually into, let's talk about the new experiences way more recently than Green. So we've just ticked off the 90s and what you did after sort of school and university, and now you find yourself in lots of different coaching environments. You coach at Maidenhead in level 6, level 5, and you coach at Wellington.
And I've done, Barbarians gave me an invite, done a couple of Barbarian sessions. I would be confident enough to say that I have been and watched Rugby League, Wigan. I've been in, not so much recently, Eddie Jones. Certainly in his early days, I would go and put kit on and run around with the guys once or twice a season, which was fascinating to pick up that. And I stay in touch with a lot of coaches. If you're writing and analysing and doing detail, you've got to stay current. You've got to stay on top of the game. So there's that element of fulfilling that perspective by going and watching senior top level coaches. And the other thing, rugby's in my DNA. You know, Tuesday and Thursday night, people go, why ain't Dan at Maidenhead? It's like, because I love rugby. You like listening to music, or, you know, you like going to concerts. I like sticking kit on, running around, having a game of touch. And helping a younger group try and be the best version of themselves. So I've never done the badges, or not, they're not called badges, are they? What are they called, Kyle?
Levels, qualifications.
Never done the levels and the qualifications, but I'd like to feel I'm pretty confident if I was sat next to Gatland or Lancaster to be able to chew the fat about what's going on in the world of coaching. And I just love the game. I think it's something that's given the Greenwood family. My dad was an England captain in the 60s, coached England in the 80s. We lived 6 years in Italy. It's given us so much. It's very difficult to let go of that.
What have you noticed across your time watching coaching and watching teaching? You've been watching a lot of my lessons for the last 4 or 5 years. What have you noticed in the changes in coaches' approaches to rugby and teachers' approaches to teaching? As you say, you grew up with two teachers.
I think the ability of teachers and coaches now, certainly in the 21st century, to treat young people as adults and to allow them to explore and create this sort of sponge mindset of wanting to find out why this works. The old system, I mean, if you go terminology, the old system was rote. This is where you stand. This is what you do. My way or highway. As opposed to now, here's a platform, here's a structure. How do you see it? And we were just talking, I mean, to bring this back to maths. Yesterday we were doing the... with the lighthouse and looking down on the boat, and we saw the same question in two different ways. And it's how children see it. And I think there's that old quote, which I always seem to forget. I might have it in the background here because I write quotes around. If you've lost the kid, it's not their problem. You've got to find a different way of teaching them. And I think that's what's been most apparent to me in the modern game and the modern classroom, is the almost delegation of responsibility to the individual themselves, which will give them a much greater understanding of the game and their topic going forward, as opposed to producing 35 parrots.
Hector, I think it's probably fair to say you've had your ups and downs with certain teachers, with certain coaches. I mean, the student you've been over the last 5 years, certainly, again, you and me have had our moments as well. So who would you say is your favourite teacher or coach that you've had at Wellington, and why? What is it they've done?
Oh, I can say you, sir. I'd definitely say... one of the teachers would be you, sir. Sort of that getting that sort of understanding between especially when I'm in the upper years, that sort of friendship as well as sort of teachership, and sort of getting that balance in between and sort of getting to understand us as actual people. And as Green's talked about, like that delegation of responsibility, giving us our own responsibility, giving us our own roles and all of this does help and go a long way in us cooperating with you and making sort of the relationship between teacher and students far better. And I think that's really important. That's something definitely you do, which is great. That's been good over the past few years.
That's good. And Grease, I know Hector, you'll be able to phrase it better than me, but when we were talking off air before, you were saying you were interested in how that might change in a professional environment or in the 2003 World Cup squad, that sort of relationship aspect.
Yeah.
Lots of questions for Greens around sort of Clive and that sort of thing.
I saw something in the newspaper not so long ago about sort of the coaching aspects and getting, which you've written actually. And I just wanted to know, what is it about Sir Clive Woodward that is so different, keeps him away from other coaches, but makes him stand out as an excellent coach? Because I know you talk quite fondly of him, and whether there's a current sort of role he could play within the current setup for England.
Yeah, so the most important thing, the biggest ability of Clive was he allowed you to be the best version of yourself. So he picked people for their strengths. He was ruthless. I mean, absolutely ruthless. You let him down. You spoke to the press and let things slide. He totally believed in keeping it within the container, but he'd go in a battle for you and he'd pick you for what you could do, not drop you for what you couldn't. And then he'd have arguments with his coach and delegate to it. And if the defensive coach, like, you know, I didn't get on that well with Phil Larder to begin with because he thought I couldn't tackle. and Clive went, well, I'm picking him. You're a defensive coach. Teach him how to tackle. I mean, I simplify it a little bit. And in the end, me and Phil, I became defensive captain by 0-2 sort of stuff and understanding the relationship I picked with him. So what Clive was so good to understand was get me best people for certain bits and I'll put them together, and then the bits they can't do, you know what, that's what I want my coaches for. Transitioned our mindset from being happy to do all right in the Five Nations, which then became the Six Nations, and occasionally bloodying the nose of a Southern Hemisphere giant, to actually say there's only one definition of greatness in the modern game, and that's winning a World Cup. And so occasionally we might lose, not on purpose, I hasten to add. We were throwing games in order to try and improve. But he understood the telescope version of it all as opposed to the microscope version of it all, which was what's our long-term goal, what's our long-term strategy, win the World Cup. Let's put some tactics into place with different games. They might not work, but we'll find out what doesn't work. And that'll put us in a better position to go for the summit of something that really means something, as opposed to doing quite well and being an okay England team and surviving, which I think English rugby had focused on for far too long. So he was great. He brought KPIs, he changed our vocabulary, talked about world-class performance and performance, high-performance behaviours. I mean, that really was a scrums, attacks, line-outs, but suddenly we felt like an elite team. He brought in some amazing coaches, some consultants who helped us understand how we could start second halves, better change shirts, a host of things he did. And he was never afraid to fail. Let's go for it. And you know what? Fail fast, we cut it, we move on. So he was great. I mean, he had a pretty good team. Well, he did have a pretty good team, but I will absolutely shout people down if they say we could have won it without him. Factually incorrect. That team would not have won the World Cup without him.
I really like the language around telescopic and microscopic viewpoints, and it's one that came out of the article that you're talking about, actually, Hector, I think. And one thing I think, Greens, you'd have some view on, in particular from now being a parent on the sideline. And one thing we see a lot from all parents, not school, club, and you'll have seen it at Rocco, his little club, or watching Archie as a parent of him. What advice would you give to these guys that perhaps sometimes forget that there is a telescopic view to this as well, as a microscopic view to every game and every moment and every decision.
Yeah, so from a parental perspective, it is, to begin with, having watched some of the outstanding coaching going on at Welly, it's trying to be patient. You don't want to be knocking on the door and smashing down. But I also don't want to preach to any parents. I don't want to come across here as I'm some sort of disciple of parenting. Oh, my God, I get so many things wrong. But I think too many parents live vicariously through their children. And by that, I mean they're living their sporting aspirations and dreams through their kids and forcing it upon them and demanding success and brilliance and excellence every time. And you forget they're still, they might have beards at 17, but they're still 17 from that perspective. So I think that's probably the most important thing, to allow the kids to fail and just to be there to pick them up and support them. And when they ask for help, you be... I know we've talked about not ruinous empathy. You don't tell them they're great when they're actually not doing so great. But at the same stage, you got to have that sort of rigor of that candidness to be honest and that open feedback. I don't know if I've answered the question from the parental perspective, but certainly from the playing perspective, from the kids, I think where you're going to get more from coaches is energy and enthusiasm, an ability to want to at least convey a perspective and attitude that wants to improve, that wants to be better, and work with it. There's nothing like a coach having to say the same things 36 times and not really caring about it. And you forget sometimes as a pupil, you feel teachers are there to serve you. Actually, the reality is it's such a two-way relationship, and the kids that really get it mind that and mind that deeply. I feel as though I've missed the main crux of your question there, but as with all things, I'm just sort of trying to put my view on what I think you've asked me.
It comes from a position that Hector and I had a really interesting experience with the Sevens this year, where we took them up to train with Zebra and Millfield, who we would consider to be the two best sides in the country at the time. So microscopically, i.e. on that day, Hector would probably admit, didn't want to be there, on the bus there, why are we doing this? We're showing them something, this is going to be really hard, we might get thumped, we might lose all four sort of training games, we haven't got our best squad, etc. But telescopically, and I guess this is where, Hector, you talk about sort of delegating responsibility, afterwards you look at it and go, oh, I can see what the long-term goal was there. And I mean, we didn't get to Roslyn Park, obviously, because of these tragic circumstances. But is that something that coaches have done with you, Hector, sort of as you've got older, maybe they've got better in sort of sharing the big picture as well as each individual decision?
Yeah, definitely. I think one point that out is actually at the start of this season, the 15 season, we sat down for the first few sessions and we actually set out long-term goals, what we wanted to achieve over the whole season, instead of this match, then next match, then next match. But setting out these long-term goals actually is really beneficial, and it's something you really remember and you want to stick by and you really want to achieve these. So yeah, I think looking at it as a sort of big picture in a way actually was all very beneficial, then taking these little steps towards achieving that big picture. I definitely think coaches have implemented that throughout sort of my time playing rugby, some more than others. Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's a super important point. And coaches talk a lot, and Eddie talks a lot about sort of involving players in that process, in the telescope part of the process, but the microscope process, that's what coaches are there to do, really. So players trusting coaches that if they're making a substitution, they think that's in the best reason for the long-term goal. And you've talked there a lot as well, Greens, a lot about creating chances to fail, not wanting you to lose, not wanting you to fail, but creating opportunities where you could have some safe uncertainty, I guess. Let's sort of go on to then chances where that did actually happen. So what would be, Hector, what would be your sort of worst moment at Wellington in terms of a sporting moment? We might have already talked about it, but and talk about your sort of experiences and your memories of bouncing back from that.
We touched on it. It was the concussion in the NatWest final. So got it in the semi-final, and wasn't able to play in the NAWAS final. Hearing that was absolutely devastating, as that was sort of a huge dream I was so excited about, and been sort of so important throughout the whole season and getting to this final so we can play at Twickenham, which seemed unreal and so cool. But yeah, unfortunately, was concussed, wasn't able to play, which, look back at it now, and I sort of think, I mean, in a way, it was a great lesson for me, actually, because although it did make my fifth form, sort of start of fifth form year harder, it taught me to sort of fight a lot more for what I had and what I could potentially achieve. And definitely coming back into the side with a bit more competition in fifth form, I think it really taught me to sort of have a bit more resilience and not give up as easily, and just keep pushing and sort of fighting for that position, fighting for those moments so you can remember them and you can stay in as long as possible. So yeah, I think bouncing back from that was an important lesson, and yeah, it was helpful in sort of making sure my rugby carried on sort of a stronger path, and sort of enjoying every moment I played instead of sort of feeling as if this has to be done, and if this one hurts, if this doesn't hurt, you know, am I copping out or not? But yeah, definitely fighting for that sort of comeback taught me a lot, which was good. Greens, sort of what has been your lowest sort of sporting moment, and how have you bounced back from that?
I think the injuries I suffered in professional rugby were, I had sort of 5 shoulder reconstructions, swallowed my tongue, was unconscious for 17 minutes in South Africa in 97, and I had a groin injury that kept me out for nearly a year, 98-99, and those times away from the game allowed me to reflect, allowed me to do some outside learning, and reminded me of the passions I had for it. So I was able to recraft those setbacks potentially as opportunities to come back better, to come back fitter. But it certainly tested me, and there's no doubt when I had that 9 months out with an undiagnosed groin injury at 98-99, I was as close to ever quitting as I've ever got to. In terms of on the field, the defeats that still hurt most, which ones really bug me? Getting beat at Twickenham in 04 by Ireland. We came back from the World Cup, and we really, a lot of us, including me, should probably have had their hands shaken by Clive Woodward and said, thanks for everything you've done, but you're not needed anymore. But he kept a few of us old guard along. And the reason it niggles me most is that team was so much better than we played that day. And I don't mind losing, by the way. I know this sounds strange. Why am I mentioning it? I don't mind losing when you give everything, you play hard, and you get beat by a better team. Because that happens. What's sometimes difficult, the ones that are difficult to stomach when I look back on it, are the days when you just go, you couldn't look yourself in the mirror after the game, and you know you took a shortcut. You know you hit on the blind side. You know, you had a little breather and you thought someone else would do it. And then you begin to understand the whole framework around which you built that World Cup glory is slowly disintegrating. So that was pretty tough, because it sort of felt like the beginning of the end for that team, even though it was a pretty special team. And then probably Paris in 2002, when Serge Betson went after Johnny. And we played pretty well. I think we lost our 2 points. That for some reason still really, really, really bugs me. And I felt we should have won that day. So those two.
Cool. I'm just gonna finish off with you, Greens, while we got you for another couple of minutes. I'm interested in how you then take all of these experiences. So we've got super positive, and we've talked so much about the really positive experiences of sport, and obviously this podcast is here to tell people how good sport is and the reason why we love it. So that's why we focus on that. Winning the World Cup, best mates from university, still memories of like sort of who was playing ahead of you and who was getting picked in and around you, and I'm sure Hector will be the same in sort of 20 or 30 years time. How have you used that and all the bad experiences you've had, times you haven't been picked, injuries you've had, fallouts with coaches? How have you used that in the rest of what you do now? Because I know every time I speak to you, you're speaking to another business, or you're trying to do better things with your charity, or better things with your touring company, or whatever it is. What what do you do with sport now? So people that, as you say, there are people that played sport for 5 years, but they're going to be in business, aren't they, in 10 years' time, or they're going to be running some campaign. So what have you learned there? Have you got a couple of minutes there just to talk to us about what you do outside of that now?
Yeah, a lot of the learnings, a lot of the way I go about things that I do are based around the so many lessons I learned on a rugby field. Humility, work ethic. I'm a big believer. I know that you've got to have this telescopic view, but I'm a big believer in doing the little things right. You know, sometimes it sounds really strange, and I heard that one of the great lectures given by one of the great admirals in America talks about it, but I always make my bed. Always make my bed in the morning. Why do you make your bed in the morning? Because you do the first little thing right at the start of the day.
Yeah.
And it gets you in a frame of mind that says, you know what, I'm just not going to take shortcuts. And that doesn't mean you have to eat like a Tibetan monk and you're going to give up everything that might be advice, or you're not going to sit down and watch a box set because I've got to fill my time with learning. It's not. It's about setting the little standards and doing those things in such a way that gives you the best chance to be the best version of yourself. I'm a massive believer in time. I think time is everyone's greatest asset, and we're seeing, I mean, how relevant is that right now? And so don't waste other people's time. So be on time, be ready to work, be prepared, crank on, get things done in 15 that often take 30, move on, let's go do something else. So that sort of energy. And finally, I think one of the phrases I use that I picked up almost from the airplanes, put your own oxygen mask on first.
Yeah.
And people go, what's that all about? And that's not about being selfish. It's about understanding that how possibly can you help those in and around you if you have a role of responsibility, if you're not looking after yourself and not putting the sleep in and getting the 8 hours or whatever it is that is appropriate to your body clock and your feed and your rest. So that was a real whistle-stop tour to some of the things that are really important to me. I like to do the little things right all the time, and that occasionally comes across that I'm really intense, but I just feel that life, you know, use the analogy of life, is like a jigsaw, just one bit at a time. Don't think about this 500-piece thing. Oh, my God, never going to do it. Just do, find the corners, find the sides, find the colours, put together, and bang, and away you go. And those are the core elements of what I try and do. And surround yourself with people who give you feedback, man. You know, if you want to surround yourself with worshippers, go to church. But the rest of your time, surround yourself with good, honest people who are prepared to call you out when you need to be called out.
Thank you so much, Will Hector. Have you got a last question for Greens, or is that answered everything you want?
He's answered everything I want. So yeah, thank you very much, Greens.
All right, dude. That's all right. And as you go on university and you run that move that you love doing, which is the, what's it called? The split up the middle.
Yes.
Pre-call it, dude. Pre-call it. You ain't the fly half you're going to be playing with wherever you go ain't going to be Carlos Spencer. Pre-call it and give yourself a chance in life. Yeah, exactly. Load the dice, man. That's what life is. Load the dice.
Yeah.
Or is it die? Do you load the die or the dice?
Well, dice. There'll be more than one.
Good. Thank you.
Cheers, Greens. Catch up with you later.
Take easy. I'll click
off. Take care of yourself.
Ta-da.
So, Hector, before we sort of round off and talk about what we can take from what Greens has just said, I know you've spoke to him a lot, so some of that won't be new, but I guess you've got some things that you've learned there that you've never asked him. I'm interested in what you're thinking about Wellington in terms of the sport that you've had at Wellington. Is there something you would change about Wellington sport? Now, this isn't your own individual experience, but someone who I know thinks about these sorts of things and you have a few opinions. So what is there something you would change or that you would make better at Wellington?
Around sort of sport? Well, I mean, one thing I'd kind of love to do, I've always sort of wanted to play football as well as rugby a bit. I think just giving sort of those people more of an option definitely would be one great thing. But then again, it's not exactly enough time in the year to be able to do all of these things. So I think the way Wellington to manage it is great, actually. But then again, around sort of if we're talking about sort of prestige around sports, one thing I'd like to sort of see as I move on and these new years come up through sport is sort of the, so when I remember when joining in third form and hearing about sort of who was the first team in the first team rugby, and it was all this amazing sort of show, and you know, these people were really well known and stuff, and sort of the prestige around rugby was upheld really high, and I feel like in the last few years as I sort of made my way up school, it's deteriorated slightly, and I'm a believer in sort of, it would be great if that sort of that in the sort of respectful aspect where it sort of just calms back up, and then maybe that with all other sports as well, with the girls' hockey and netball, and boys' football and stuff. So I think, yeah, just really importantly, just sort of recognition for sort of each sport, and keeping that sort of branded high is definitely important.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think, interestingly, when you talk about the sort of playing other sports, that was Sam's biggest regret. When we had Sam on a couple of weeks ago, he was saying he wished he played a bit more. And one of Darcy's really good memories of playing school is the house sport, because it gave her an opportunity to play other sports. So a lot of you guys who have played whatever sport to your highest level, and I know the people listening to this, there'll be a few of those guys that have missed out on those opportunities. And that, what's really cool then when you do, for those that are going to university, is there is then that option, because you can play for your college, you can play for your you can play for your department, you can play for whatever, you can join a six-a-side league, you can do all those things again, because you've now got 7 days in a week. And obviously your time at Wellington, if some other boarding schools have Sunday house sport, right, so you could have played house football every week if it was at a different school. But that opportunity is afforded to you when you go back to university now, and I think that's an important thing. And that was a key message from Sam and Darcy, certainly. They were talking about, yes, they're really happy with what they did in their own individual sport, and I'm sure you're happy that you've got some great memories from rugby. But there is that admittance that actually there's a bit of regret that other sports therefore had to drop out, for example. So just then to finish off, Hector, what would you say your sort of main takeaways would be from speaking to Greens there?
So firstly, sort of the transition between school and uni, and sort of those sort of that split between doing your sport, getting your friendship group sorted, and all of this just helps you on your way of sort of having a positive life at uni, and definitely then sort of a positive career in what sport you want to take through uni. I think that was really important what you were saying, and just sort of making sure you sort of keep up with what you want to be doing. And don't get sort of too overwhelmed with everything, but just try and just keep trying at everything. Even if you get sort of knocked to the side, or you're not in the first team at uni, you're in the fourth or thirds. And as Greenwood said, he loved the rugby, so he just carried on fighting, and made sure he at one point could get there and get the recognition he so needed. So that one aspect was really important, I think. Is sort of talk about sort of the telescopic and micromanagement thing of coaching was really important. I know I can't actually remember who it was, but in fifth form, in our match at St. Michael's, I think it was a professional rugby player, played for Ireland. He came in.
Gordon Darcy?
That was it. And he came in, one thing that stuck in my head, and actually a lot of the boys in my team, which we always say before every match, is 61-minute battles. And so sort of that, just if you win this battle, great, move on to the next one. If you lose that one, so what? Move on to the next one. It's 61-minute battles. I think that was really important. And I feel that looking at it as a big picture, that's 60 minutes. If you can win the majority of those 1 minutes, which is all the small micromanaging bits, you've got that whole 60 minutes on lockdown. So just those sort of micromanaging and making sure you can sort of be the best person you can be in those short periods of times and achieve what you want to, will make your bigger picture look even better. So I thought that was really important.
Absolutely. I've written down surrounding himself in positive people. I think that's exactly what you said, that like Frosty was talking so well about his university experiences, and you might not have the same resource you have at public school. You might not have coaches. You might only get 30 minutes on a training field, but if you've got 20 people around you that enjoy their company, you'd make it work. So absolutely. And I think, yeah, that idea of how can I be really good the next day? Take the Admiral's approach. Like, what's the first thing I can do really well in the morning? I can make my bed. Yeah. Then what can I do? I can go make some good food. Then what can I do? I can go for a walk. And just as you say, and if you get the next one decision wrong, who cares? There's a million decisions to make in a day. So just get the majority of them right. Absolutely. Yeah. Hector, thank you so much. Look after yourself. Send my love to the family and take care during this weird time.
Yeah.
Cheers, Hector. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Take care.
Cheers, sir. Thank you.
One talking, feeling on a cloud, not of my own design.